You're listening to Greater LA from KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiotakis. Can you believe it? We're in the middle of Hanukkah. Christmas is this weekend. New Year's Day, of course, is just around the corner. And so is the annual Tournament of Roses Parade in Pasadena.
Spartan marching band makes its entrance.
Traditionally, local cities have built floats to advertise themselves, proudly showing themselves off.
The people of the city of Downey, California, built and decorated this next float, Bert.
Using mainly volunteer efforts. But now most floats are built by professionals at a cost of hundreds of thousands of dollars. Most floats, but not all of them.
The Pasadena Rose Float Association only has six rose float entries that are self-built. Downey, the city of Downey being one of them.
That's Downey's mayor, Claudia Fermetta.
That is our pride and joy. It is really a gem.
This year, Downey's rose float builders found themselves short of cash because of the pandemic, putting their legacy in danger. Well, KCRW's Rebecca Ludman's been following the progress of Downey's float and brings us this report.
A self-built float is one that is not professionally built, and they don't allow new ones into the parade. Downey's was grandfathered in. Here's Kelly Roberts, the construction chairman.
If there's a year that Downey does not get a float in the parade, from my understanding, we will not be back in the parade again.
So, before anybody attaches any roses to a steel frame to roll down Colorado Boulevard, people in Downey have spent months working to raise the money to build the float. Roberts tells me this float would have cost about $375,000 if they had outsourced it to the pros. Instead?
Probably going to be right around $65,000, $70,000 when it's all said and done with the construction cost and all the decorating materials.
$70,000 is still a lot for a community organization. And up until this year, they raised the money with no city help. This year, the city kicked in half. The rest is a community effort. Back in October, Downey raised at least $6,000 with a local tradition.
I'd like to welcome you all to this evening's 2023 Miss Downey pageant.
The Downey Rose Float Association held their 66th annual Miss Downey Beauty Pageant for the first time since 2020. About two dozen girls and young women compete for the titles of Little Miss Downey, Junior Miss Downey, Miss Teen Downey, and Miss Downey.
Our contestants are moving back out onto the stage.
They introduce themselves to a crowd of adoring family members. They strut the stage in first day of school outfits, and they sparkle in evening gowns. And after about 4 hours, the judges have picked their winners.
Your new 2023 Miss Downey is contestant number 5, Sarah.
High school senior Sarah Seraphim wins a scholarship and the opportunity to ride on top of Downey's float in the Rose Parade. Julie Ledesma, the vice president of the Downey Rose Float Association, says she was honored when she won Miss Downey 5 years ago. But the parade experience was hard.
I was at the very top, like probably 15 feet off the floor, and all that's holding me up there is a seatbelt. And I'm standing the whole time, and I'm in a dress, and I was freezing and like could not feel my feet by the end of it.
The beauty pageant is their second largest fundraising event. Downey's Rose Float Association also brought in about $55,000 from a community-run fireworks stand that opened before July 4th. Together, those fundraisers got the Downey Rose Float back on its wheels. That just leaves the biggest mountain to climb, actually building this thing. This year, the float's theme is Be Inspired, like the insect. It will feature a huge honeycomb, animatronic bees, and of course, lots and lots of roses. Kelly Roberts has been involved in building the city of Downey's float submission for 43 years.
Maybe I've been here too long.
And it all started when?
I snuck out of my parents' house when I was like 9 and jumped a fence and met my friends in the next block over and came down to decorate a rose parade float.
For the past 6 months, after his day job as a safety engineer, Roberts heads over to the barn where they build the float. There's music playing and sparks flying everywhere from cutting the steel and welding. 3 weeks ago, the community got a sneak peek of the float.
Today we're at the Downey Holiday Christmas Parade.
A steel and foam skeleton of the float, painted green, rolls slowly down the street. The Miss Downey princesses stand on it waving, showing off to Downey residents the float that will represent them in a few weeks in Pasadena. Roberts is busy.
We're just running the mechanics on the inside of the float, the drive engine, checking temperatures, pressures, voltages, how it steers, how it brakes, how it accelerates.
As the float reaches the end of the parade, the princesses hop off and it rolls back to the barn to get ready for 45 million Rose Parade viewers. Construction has to be done by December 26. It's their top priority, even with the holidays. Robert says he'll be working on the float on Christmas Day to get it done in time for volunteers to attach $30,000 worth of flowers. Downey Mayor Claudia Frometta says when she sees her city's float, built not by professionals, but by her city's residents.
I can't describe the feeling. It really is a feeling of this is ours, right? This is our community. And it's an opportunity to come together and be able to interact with people that have the same love and passion and dedication for the city of Downey. And they want to do this beautiful float that represents the community they've called home since they were kids. And so that's really, really special.
Be Inspired will roll down Colorado Boulevard on January 2nd, along with the other five self-built floats that still remain in the parade. For KCRW, I'm Rebecca Ludman.
Coming up, it's been dubbed the Mansion Tax. It's set to add hundreds of millions of dollars every year toward homeless and affordable housing. But will it dissuade people from selling their expensive homes to developers? And can there be changes made to what was approved by voters just last month? That's ahead after this short break.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Moving on now with Greater LA from KCRW, I'm Steve Chiotakis. The November election is long over, but the ballot initiatives have passed? Well, soon you get to see them in action, like Measure ULA, which added a tax on residential and commercial property sales in the city beginning in April. 4% on properties of more than $5 million, 5.5% on ones over $10 million. The money will go toward affordable housing and homeless prevention. But the LA Times reports that some property owners are already searching for ways around Measure ULA. And even supporters of it worry it may actually reduce the quantity of housing construction in general. Shane Phillips is Housing Initiative Project Manager over at UCLA's Lewis Center for Regional Policy Studies. Shane, welcome to you.
Thank you.
What are the ways that people are trying to avoid ULA? And did anyone, you included, see this coming?
Yeah, I think it was foreseen. And, you know, I think the two ways that people are trying to avoid the tax right now is first, just selling before it goes into effect. I don't believe it comes into effect until around April or so. So if you can sell before then, some people are trying to do that. And I think that was completely expected. The other, you know, my understanding is that some owners of high value properties might be trying to kind of split them up into separate ownership entities and selling each one separately. I don't actually think that that's legal, but some might try to do it. And so there's a concern that there might be a little bit of that. But I think mostly it will be people trying to just sell as quickly as possible before the tax goes into effect.
Do you think this was kind of baked in, you know, this circumventing that I would imagine the people who put this measure together would have foreseen, right?
Yeah, I know for a fact that the projections for revenues don't account for this. That's because this is just going to be a one-time thing. What I'm really interested in is what is the ongoing year after year revenue that's going to come in from this. And I think on that, their projections of, you know, around $900 million, $1 billion a year are probably pretty accurate.
But I wonder, though, is the simple byproduct of that there are fewer housing units being built because people aren't wanting to sell to developers who may come in and want to build these multi-unit housing developments?
That really is my main concern here, that Measure ULA is going to do a lot of great things. I voted for it. I support the things it's going to spend this money on, including the construction of affordable housing, but it's going to do a lot of other things as well, including a right to counsel for tenants facing eviction, rent assistance, things like that. But ultimately, there is a really valid concern that when you impose a new tax on these projects, the developers who are planning these projects, they can't actually charge more in rent just because their taxes have gone up. And they can't really cut costs in terms of how they build their project for the most part. There's only so much, you know, cost saving you can get out of that. And so what's really going to happen is they're going to have to take the cost of that tax out of what they pay for land. And, you know, a 5% tax on a, you know, big project might not sound like a lot, but when all of the money has to come out of the land price and land is maybe, you know, 20% of the total cost of development, you're talking about paying 25, 30, 35% less for land. And there are a lot of owners of land who just aren't going to want to sell to a developer at that price. And so that's really my kind of big concern here, is that by imposing this tax on all sales, including the sales of newly, you know, redeveloped properties, we're going to see a reduction in housing production. And that's both, you know, market rate, which has been shown to help with affordability, but is pretty high price, admittedly, but also below market housing that's reserved for low-income households and set at rents that are affordable to them. The private market builds more than 1,000 of those units in the city of LA every year. And to the extent that those are at risk, we could just be kind of trading one funding source for losing privately financed below market units on the other hand.
So what then is the remedy to that? I mean, how do you fix that?
Yeah, and this is part of why, even knowing that this could be a problem, I still voted for the initiative, because the initiative does say that city council has the authority to amend it if it sort of furthers the purposes of the initiative, which include building lots of or having lots of affordable housing. And I think the people who wrote the initiative would agree, you know, if we could build more affordable housing total by exempting new multifamily mixed income developments, which is what I'm proposing, then we should do that. And ultimately, you know, I've looked at the numbers, and if we were to exempt new multifamily developments on their first sale. So say you build a project and 6 years later you sell it, that first sale is exempt from this tax. Anytime it's sold in the future, it would still pay, but that first sale is exempt so that they don't have to take that hit on the land value and everything. It's a very minimal cost, actually, and it sort of avoids us getting in this place which I think is where we're headed, which is we've created this new funding source that's going to help pay for an additional maybe 2,000 or 3,000 below market affordable units per year. But in so doing, we're creating a drag on the tens of thousands of units we need to be building in addition to that. The city has a goal of about 55,000 new homes per year over the coming 8 years. And so we just can't let this funding source for 3,000 units become a drag on the production of those other 50,000 plus.
When you look at this, Measure ULA, and this is, again, something that goes through my head, just being a journalist in LA, we had Measure H and Measure Triple H that were passed several years ago here in LA. And, you know, you're talking about hundreds upon hundreds of billions of dollars going toward affordable housing. And it's like, how does that factor into what happens with Measure ULA and how it gets funded in the future?
My big takeaway from Measure HHH. I think it's been a really important case study in how, you know, funding helps. It has helped build, Measure HHH has helped build thousands of units for people experiencing homelessness, for low-income households. It has done a ton of good, but it's also made it so clear that just spending more money on affordable housing and these needs is not enough by itself. It is still 100% the case that unless we address the fundamental scarcity of housing, the lack of production that LA has been engaged in for 30 plus years, housing prices are going to keep going up. The cost of a voucher is going to keep going up. The cost of building subsidized housing is going to keep going up. And so it has to be a partnership between these funding measures and affordable housing developers who are using public subsidies, and also this broader mission of how do we make sure there is enough housing, period, whether it's subsidized or not. And most of that is going to come from the private market.
Shane Phillips, Housing Initiative Project Manager over at UCLA's Lewis Center for Regional Policy Studies. Shane, thanks for coming on and talking to us.
Thank you.
Back now with more Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. It rained earlier this month in Southern California, and it snowed a lot up in the mountains. Maybe you've seen those white peaks through the smog as you've been driving around. Now, all that snow means ski and snowboarding season are here as folks hit the slopes, or maybe sit warmly inside by the fire and watch other people hit the slopes. Whatever. There's the mammoth crowd, of course. But closer to home, the place you can ski on the same day that you can surf is Big Bear in the San Bernardino Mountains. And there's a lot happening up there, including eyes on water and snowpack, lodging and housing concerns, and even accessibility. Kathy Porty is editor of the Big Bear Grizzly, the local weekly newspaper there. And Justin Canton is with Big Bear Mountain Resort. And welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Justin, I'll start with you. The season has already seen some significant snowfall. I know the Sierra Nevada got hammered. How about y'all up in Big Bear?
Well, we definitely have seen significant snowfall, but not quite to the extent as they're seeing in Mammoth and Tahoe and places like that, which all intents and purposes is probably for the best considering our guests are typically the more moderate, you know, introductory to beginner level. So they may not be as experienced driving in those conditions. But since the 1st of November, we've reached close to 2 feet of natural snowfall. And then we have made snow beyond that. And so our base depths are about 24 to 36 inches right now at Bear Mountain and Snow Summit.
Kathy Porty, unlike much of Southern California, Big Bear gets all of its water locally. What happens if you don't get enough water?
Well, you know, just like anywhere else in California, there are water restrictions, and we're at level two right now. I think most of the state is, you know, to try to conserve water. But you're right. We're not on the state water system, and we don't get water from Colorado River. It is strictly what we get from the sky and our that fills up our aquifers. And but we're in pretty good shape. It's surprising, but it's a very large aquifer, and we're able to manage water for consumption.
Justin, how do you all determine when to manufacture snow? You said you have been obviously manufacturing. It's certainly been cold enough up there. How do you guys do it, and when do you know to do it?
So there are some certain conditions that need to be in place, typically low temperatures of 32 below wet bulb temp, low to moderate humidity, and preferably low to no wind so that we can actually disperse the snow where we want it to go. You know, we don't just make snow to make it. We only make it when the conditions permit and when we have an actual use for it. And so we try to make sure that we're only producing snow that we're going to use and that there's minimal to no waste involved in that process. Typically what we use snowmaking for is to really get our base depth set and dialed in and locked in so that we're not losing snow over the season. And then we'll look to augment here and there throughout the season until really about early February is when we stop. So we really only make snow for a few months to start the season. And then we rely primarily on either what we've made or what occurs naturally.
Let's talk a little bit about housing. This is obviously a very big topic in Southern California where things are very expensive. Housing is among the most expensive in the country. And Kathy, I know you live in the community there. How do you manage? I mean, do you rent? Do you own? Have you been able to afford it? It's an expensive place to live for sure, isn't it?
It is. And there's fewer houses available for rent right now that is a big part of our employment and workforce. You know, they rely on rents. I am a renter myself, but I've been lucky because I've been in the same house for over 7 years and they haven't raised my rent, you know, to high levels yet. So I'm pretty good there. And so are quite a few other people who have had that luck and have been here for quite a while. It's mainly affecting new renters and temporary seasonal workers.
To what Kathy said, Justin, Big Bear, which, you know, obviously is a resort town, it's an expensive place to live. How do your seasonal employees, you work there, right, at the resort, how do you find housing up there? How are they able to afford housing, given how much it costs?
Yeah, that's absolutely one of our biggest challenges and concerns, especially in the wintertime, because, you know, not only does it take a lot of snow to get a ski resort open, it takes a lot of people and a lot of physical people on the ground. So that's been a challenge we've really tried to focus on the last couple of years to try and help offset when and where we can. Starting with this last season, we decided to up our minimum wage across the board. So if you've never worked here before and you just started this season, you're coming in making $19 an hour. And then we've obviously escalated people up the chain as their seniority dictates. Beyond that, we did go ahead in this last season and purchase a local lodging property that was for sale, and we're actually converting that into employee housing to help offset some of the challenges faced by our seasonal and international employees.
Before you all say goodbye to us, I do want to ask about accessibility and demography, Kathy, because, you know, winter sports have historically been pretty white. In your reporting up there, have you noticed a change in accessibility, a change in getting more diverse populations involved in skiing or getting more people up there who can enjoy what Big Bear has to offer?
Anecdotally, I would say yes. I have noticed in recent years that more and more people from a variety of backgrounds are taking advantage of what Big Bear has to offer, not only in the winter, but also in the summer. I don't know, Justin, are you seeing the same thing? I certainly am.
Absolutely. And I can tell you from the resort standpoint, that's something that we've definitely focused on the last 4 to 5 seasons, in addition to, you know, the challenges with snowmaking and natural snow and housing and those sort of things. One of the things that we do want to emphasize, you know, whether it's through our marketing materials, our communications to the public, are the fact that this is an accessible sport for people. We do try to make it accessible both in terms of our product offerings, our pricing, our events, you know, having more diverse events. And then, you know, I'd be remiss if I didn't just point out the fact that we're up the hill from 22 million people and the Southern California market is fairly diverse to begin with. So that definitely does help us. But it's also been a concerted effort on the resort's part to try.
I mean, there is something called income inequality as well, though. I mean, not everybody has the same ability to get up that mountain, right?
Very true. Absolutely. And so, you know, we've tried to make it more accessible in certain ways through advanced purchase discounts. We have programs for local kids and residents. So where we can, we do try to offset that when possible. But at the same time, we are kind of constrained by certain financial restrictions as well.
How about people with disabilities? What kind of access do they have?
We do have a full USARC training course or training program at Bear Mountain. That's an adaptive program that operates every day that Bear Mountain operates. That includes anything from people with learning disabilities to physical disabilities. We have, you know, guys out there riding in mono skis all the time. We have blind skiers with guides. So we do try to be, again, as inclusive and open to anybody that wants to come and experience and enjoy the recreation that we have.
Kathy Porte, editor of the Big Bear Grizzly, Justin Canton with Big Bear Mountain Resort. Thanks to you both for coming on. Happy holidays to you both.
Thank you.
Same to you.
That's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow, you're going to hear from LA's new city council member, Tracy Park. She takes over from Mike Bonin in District 11. But her views on homelessness and what to do about it are a little different from her predecessors. That's tomorrow on GLA. How about you? What are your views? Do you have a story idea for us? You can let us know at our website, kcrw.com/GLA. And, of course, subscribe to the podcast, too, while you're there. Juliana Mayo, Nihar Patel, Zeke Reed, Sonia Geis, Arnie Seipel, Nick Lamponi, Phil Richards, Amy Tuck, Carlos Ramirez, and Holly Adams all had hands in this evening's episode. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thank you for your ears. Happy holidays. Have a great night.